Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. Well, yesterday the Governor General read the long-awaited throne speech for the government. We'll discuss the details and get some feedback. Donald Trump refuses to commit to a peaceful transition of power if he loses in November. Global News correspondent Reggie Cicchini joins us from Washington to talk about that. London area businesses are calling for support due to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Will they get it? We'll talk about it. And here in Hamilton, fears of a deficit for this year have been avoided, for the time being anyway, due to emergency grants. How much is it going to offset it? We'll throw some numbers at you. The Bill Kelly Podcast starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
To begin with today, obviously Ottawa yesterday with the throne speech and the reaction to that. And then, of course, last evening, the Prime Minister and the other major leaders of all the political parties addressed the nation. And we're going to get into that in a couple of seconds. But let's begin with the throne speech. As per usual, it was delivered by the Governor General, Julie Payette. But that's about the only thing that was usual about this. It was different, obviously, because of COVID-19, a much different circumstance. Took a long way to get going, didn't it? Coverage started at 1:30, and I think it was after 3 before the Governor General actually started to speak. But she set a very somber tone, at least the government did with her comments, as the Governor General promised to help deal with the economic consequences of the pandemic.
This is not the time for austerity. Canada entered this crisis in the best fiscal positions of its peers, and the government is using that fiscal firepower on things like the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, and on the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy.
So that set the tone. This is not the time for austerity. And they spent into great detail through the course of the speech talking about an extension of some existing assistance programs and some new wrinkles to it as well. We begin our coverage with the government side. Pleased to welcome to the program Philomena Tassie, who is, of course, the Minister of Labour in the Trudeau government and also the MP for Hamilton West, Ancaster and Dundas. Philomena, thank you so much for the time. I know it's a busy time for you. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the substance of it, and I'm going to try to put this in the context of what we've heard from some of the opposition parties. We're going to hear from them in just a little bit. Not a time for austerity, yet at the same time, you're getting an awful lot of pressure from economists and bank presidents and everybody else that, look, the spending is out of control. I don't know if we can handle this. And then on top of that, you've got the news about what looks like the second wave of COVID, which is upon us. So talk to us about those challenges and how your government came up with this proposal.
Well, first and foremost, the issue of, that the second wave is upon us, I think, is critical. And, you know, the throne speech started with that in terms of the first pillar. And it's really important that we as a government continue to assure Canadians that we're going to provide them with the support in order to keep them healthy and well. And so, you know, the testing is a perfect example. As you're aware, we've given $19 billion to the provinces and territories as part of the Safe Start Agreement so that tests can be provided quickly and responsibly and effectively. And so I think the message is loud and clear here that, folks, we're not through this. Like, and now more than ever, because as numbers are rising, it's really important that we follow the protocols and, do all the things that are suggested. Wear masks, cough into our arms, wash our hands as often as possible, keep the social physical distancing practices in place, because we absolutely don't want to get into a position where we're in another spike. And then the second part, of course, Bill, is providing the supports. And I think that it's important to recognize that these supports are needed by Canadians. And if we don't respond, if we don't provide the supports, at the end of the day, it's going to cost more. We can't have inaction here. We have to have action. And the example I think about is the CERB support. So you know that we've offered the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit to almost 9 million Canadians. If that benefit were not offered, you would have Canadians who have lost their homes, not able to pay their mortgages, and the situation would be dire. It was that much needed support that have put Canadians in a place that they can still be in their homes, and that as we move forward, as was articulated in the throne speech, and work to provide Canadians with jobs, those Canadians now will be able to uptake those jobs.
Well, let's talk about that, because we were promised, and of course it's speculative until the Governor General actually starts speaking, that there was going to be this huge economic recovery plan to get us out of that. Have you tempered that now because of the return of the virus? Well, the virus never left, but phase two of this virus?
I think that the way I would respond to that is to say that we've put it in context of the situation that we're in, and that is that the pandemic is here, and that our first priority is keeping Canadians safe and providing them security as we move through this pandemic. But as you know, included in the throne speech were many initiatives that we've spoken about as a government to say, look, folks, here's the path forward. It's a strong path. We believe in Canadians. We know that when we make these investments, it's going to benefit all Canadians. So, you know, things like investing in skills training, something that is so important. Creating jobs by retrofitting homes, electric vehicles and making them more affordable. We know with the great news about Oakville and the plants there that is going to be producing these vehicles. So it's, you know, ensuring that these jobs are being created so that Canadians have the ability to go to those jobs, and making those investments, because those are investments in Canadians.
There's an awful lot of pushback here and a lot of feedback, both positive and negative, about this, as you know, Felina. But a common theme among the premiers last evening, after they digested an awful lot of the throne speech, was, and I'll try to paraphrase this, I think they all acknowledge, we're in a health crisis here. I mean, and they all acknowledge the fact that it looks like the second wave is upon us, and the numbers are frightening in just about every part of this country. But they're saying, in light of that, there should have been more money directed towards the health care and towards the provinces, money for health care. I know that was a discussion that went on before the throne speech came on, but they're looking for more money to help to deal with the health care aspect of this. And just about every one of the premiers, the consensus seems to be, we don't have enough. We have to have that money. We have to have that discussion.
So in response to that, Bill, I would say, look, of course premiers are going to advocate for more funding. They want the best for their province and their territory to ensure that, their stakeholders are taken care of. And so, but I want to point to look at the support that the federal government has already given. $19 billion in a Safe Start Agreement was given to the provinces and territories. That's historic. And that was, a part of that was to ensure that they had the health supports that they needed, that they could do the testing. And now the federal government is investing in ensuring that when a vaccine is created, the research, of course, for the vaccine, but then in addition to that, ensuring that there's going to be doses that are available for all Canadians across the country. In addition, $2 billion to have, you know, a safe restart for schools, $3 billion for wage top-ups, so that those low-paid frontline workers that we are so grateful for, that have made significant sacrifices, have top-ups, because we know that, you know, in some instances, the compensation, well, let's be honest, they're not being compensated fairly for the role and the jobs that they are doing. The $2 billion in PPE, we have continuously supported our provincial and territorial partners, and we want to continue to work as a team. I think Minister LeBlanc gave the figure that it was 97 cents per dollar that the supports that have been rolled out across the country, and 3 cents by the provinces and territories. That's been the contribution. And I'm not complaining about it, but I'm saying that we as a federal government have been there for Canadians, because we recognize the importance this support is needed at this very challenging time.
Well, more to come on this, obviously. The debate starts later this afternoon, and lots more discussion to be had on this, too. Felina, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill.
Felina Tassie, of course, Minister of Labour and MP for Hamilton West, Ancaster, and Dundas. The Conservative Party was quick to respond after the throne speech, and of course, their leader, Aaron O'Toole, did respond by video last evening after the Prime Minister's address. We'll get into that in a couple of seconds. Joining us, though, to give us some feedback about the throne speech itself is David Sweet. David, of course, is the Member of Parliament for Flamborough-Glanbrook. David, welcome back to the program. Good to talk with you once again.
Bill, good to talk with you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Well, this is certainly a worthy conversation here and a worthy topic to get back into it with you, David. Let's first of all get your impressions of what you heard in the throne speech.
Well, I've done enough of these interviews over the years, and I know you're going to ask me at some point what's positive about it. So Let me start off.
Start there.
I'm glad that they're going to continue the emergency wage subsidy into next year. There's still a lot of gaps in it, but for those people that are exercising it, it's maintaining jobs, and so I'm glad that they made that commitment, and we're going to make sure that we see that in the budget.
So the other side of that coin, as he was talking about with Philomena Tassi, is the promise that the Prime Minister made through the throne speech, of course, is that we're going to do whatever it takes. Do we extrapolate from that whatever it costs to? Is that a concern to you?
Yeah. Okay. So that's the other edge of the sword, is that the wage subsidy so far has cost us $35 billion. And one of the huge gaps yesterday that I saw in the throne speech is there's absolutely no plan to manage the debt. So our deficit is ballooning at $400 billion. Our debt is now over $1 trillion. And just think about, for your listeners, because those are big numbers and they're hard to get your head around. The average house price in Hamilton is $400,000. So if you had a conventional mortgage of $350,000, let's say, and you had a good interest rate these days of 2.5%, your payment per month would be about $1,800. If it went up 1% to 3.5, it would be $2,000. You know, fully, 10%, 11% more. And right now, the debt charge that we're dealing with, if it went up 11% from $40 billion, we chew away so much revenue when we do that. And the Prime Minister did not, the Governor General in the throne speech, didn't even mention about how they're going to manage the debt.
Is that supposed to be, or should that be a priority now, or should the welfare of Canadians be a priority, as was characterized through the throne speech?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think, look, you were mentioning earlier on your interview about the premiers asking for more money for healthcare because the healthcare budget has been drained. Look, if you don't manage your expenditures, you're not able to. If you don't manage the goose that lays the golden eggs, so to speak, you can't possibly have eggs tomorrow. So, I think you need to make sure that you're spending money responsibly. And we've seen this government, over and over in situations like with the WE charity, et cetera. You've got to spend money responsibly, and you've got to make sure that you have a plan as you do that, and you're dealing with priorities to get back on track later so that you can deal with future priorities as well. I mean, look, this pandemic is the thing that's staring us in the face right now, and we need to be as aggressive as possible dealing with it. And at the same time, there's going to be issues in the future, and we need to be prepared for those as well.
If the government survives the confidence vote, and that's up in the air right now, based on some of the comments we heard last night, David, are you willing to work with them to try to massage some of these things that they're talking about doing? I mean, it is a minority government, and let's face it, they're going to need support on just about every one of these pieces of legislation in some way, shape, or form.
Bill, I've been around a while. I'm prepared to work with anybody who's prepared to be reasonable and work with us. But you can't shut down Parliament for, weeks and weeks and then bring a throne speech that isn't representative of anything that any of the opposition parties asked you to do. I mean, one of the key things that our leader asked the Prime Minister to deal with in a throne speech was to talk about Western alienation and to recognize that there's a unity issue in Canada. It wasn't even mentioned. For the riding of Flamborough-Glanbrook, for example, in a pandemic where we're ordering people to stay home, or at least asking them to stay home as much as possible and work from home, rural broadband wasn't. It's a big, big issue in Flamborough-Glanbrook and throughout all of the greater city of Hamilton.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I've heard from a lot of people that said that should have been in there. I know there was a discussion about it, and the commitment, and I'm paraphrasing that, is they're going to ramp up the program. Well, they're woefully behind already. I don't know that there's any new money in there.
No, it's a bad situation that has no remedy right now in this throne speech. Our farmers, it impacts them. I mean, our farmers are already dealing with, and they weren't mentioned to any substantial degree either. They're dealing with trade issues with China. They're dealing with temporary workers. They're dealing with a new carbon tax, really no substantive relief at all for them mentioned in the throne speech. And look, if the safety and security of our food chain is paramount. If you know, if you're talking about priorities, so I think those things needed to be in there. And there's many of, like, rapid testing should have absolutely been in there. The Premier of Ontario says that, you know, he's been hounding Health Canada to try and get an answer to rapid testing, and he says all we get is crickets.
Yeah, I know the Premier mentioned that yesterday afternoon just before the throne speech and talked about that and about some of the technologies that are used in other directions. So it's going to be interesting to see how that discussion goes. David, you guys are at it again, I guess, starting this afternoon. Just on a procedural point, if you could, since you're a veteran of all of these wars, my understanding is that the government has to allow 5 to 6 days for debate on that. Is that going to happen this time?
You know what? It's you're asking me to try to.
This is not business as usual. I know that.
Yeah, I would hope that particularly with what we've gone through with some of the ethics situations that the Liberals have got themselves into and the prorogation, that they would allow this debate to go as long as it needs to go. So we'll wait and see. Like I said, it's going to be, you know, their decision, but. Yeah, we'll wait and see exactly how the government moves. But look, we had to come out publicly the day before yesterday and reveal, which we didn't want to, because House leaders try to keep their conversations as best as possible to their chest, because it's a significant part of our operations in Parliament. But, you know, they were planning to come back without any committees. And how do you operate without committees, you know, examining legislation? It makes the House of Commons useless. So we had to come out publicly and say that that was their plan. And finally, they surrendered, and they're going to start some of the committees by, my understanding is, by October, the first week of October. And then the rest of them will be in place by October 19th. So stay tuned.
Well, all of a sudden, the Parliamentary Channel is must-see TV. We'll be watching, David. Thanks so much for the time today. Good talking with you.
Thanks, Bill.
David Sweet, of course, Member of Parliament for Flamborough Glanbrook.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Donald Trump is making comments right now to signal to his supporters that even if he loses, does not get as many votes, or even if he loses the Electoral College, he may still be in the White House. He's talking now about using the Supreme Court to decide who's going to be the president after November the 3rd, and a number of other things that are just beyond the pale, really. I want to bring Reggie Cicchini into the conversation. Reggie is the Washington producer and correspondent, of course, with Global News in the Beltway. Reggie, thank you so much for the time. Great to have you with us again today.
Good morning.
There's a lot to unpack here. Let's start with some of the comments that the president has been making over the last little while. The concern we all had about the replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, was because it was going to tip the court, obviously, to the conservative side, the small-c conservative side. And the concern was that the Supreme Court is going to hear the Affordable Care Act a week after the election, and it's in peril as a result of that. That's one line of thinking. But, Reggie, what the president is saying this day is that, look at, I may use the Supreme Court to decide who's going to be the president after this, because I'm going to challenge this right up to the Supreme Court, which makes his appointment that much more perilous. In other words, if somebody gets appointed in a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, are they going to feel beholden to Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, look, this is a very different Supreme Court in 2020 than it was 20 years ago, when the Supreme Court was used for the first and only time in deciding an election with Bush v. Gore. The difference is in 2000, the justices didn't like that they were put into that position of having to decide an election that is supposed to be decided upon by the people and the Electoral College. And they said after that decision that they never wanted 2000 to be used as any kind of legal precedent ever again going forward. Yet here you are with a very different Supreme Court, a much more partisan Supreme Court than we had 20 years ago. And the president kind of treating it as not just a separate part of kind of the three branches of government, but also as an interior part that he can kind of use for his own political gain. And that really is what has sparked fear amongst Democrats, amongst critics of the president, and even amongst some in the Republican Party, even if they aren't coming forward and saying it publicly.
Because of this, the common theme that he's been touting ever since this whole thing started, and that's, of course, that the election was rigged. Of course, he said that 4 years ago, too, but he won it, so he dropped that whole idea pretty quickly. As it turned out, it was rigged, but it was by the Russians, not by who he thought it was going to be rigged by. But it's there, and you're absolutely right. Notwithstanding evidence to the contrary, there's a significant section of Republican supporters, especially, that buy into everything he says.
Look, there is, and they are fearful of standing up to the president because, as we've seen now for 4 years, and even kind of in the run-up to 2016, President Trump can act like and be seen as a kingmaker, and if you fall out of line, you could potentially fall out of political life. The president has an ability to kind of whip up support that stands behind him and then ultimately stands behind those that are lower on the ballot. So people are fearful of breaking ranks. This is why we see somebody like Mitt Romney, who says that he will back the president's motion to put a vote forward on the floor to get somebody to replace Justice Ginsburg, while at the same time saying that he disagrees with the president's kind of rhetoric, saying that he won't, you know, go through a peaceful transition, that he thinks that the election is rigged, that he thinks that mail-in ballots are essentially a way to get the president. You have breaks in ranks, but they're convenient and they're opportune for when that conservative feels that they're going to be safe in what they say.
But when you get into the realm of legality, does that rhetoric carry or does law carry? And because that's the gray area that I think a lot of people are concerned about right now, Reggie. Can he just demand that I want a judicial review into the election? I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult since the attorney general seems to be, you know, in cahoots with Trump, just about everything Trump does. Do they have all the cards in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, look, far be it from me, who's not a constitutional scholar, to say, you know, that he has the legal ability to do this. We know that there is a precedent that the Supreme Court doesn't want to use that says, yes, in the case of something that's contested possibly in one state like it was in Florida 20 years ago, that they could be asked to pick up the pieces and decide the vote here. But again, this is a very different election. It's not just Florida Supreme Court that could be kind of caught up in a kerfuffle over an election count. It's a state like Arizona. It's a state like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin, North Carolina, Georgia, the list goes on, where there is such a close race right now, or at least an increase in numbers for Biden, that the president may simply say, look, I don't trust what the numbers are coming out of here. That is just one play. Election law in this country is difficult, to say the least. And there are other options the president could go down. He could go to state legislatures that are Republican, that lean towards him, and ask them to kind of get in the way of what the popular vote is and have them appoint electors and electoral college members that are favorable to the president and have them simply manipulate the vote. There are a number of options the president can use here, which is why there is such a fear that he is kind of eroding democracy in the free election system that the United States has.
I'm glad you brought up the Bush-Gore thing from 20 years ago, because it's different, but in some ways it's the same, because it was about disputed ballots that should or should not be counted. And the Electoral College does come into play here, because we just assume that the Electoral College members will go and vote according to the vote in that particular state. But apparently they're not bound to. They always do. I don't think there's ever been an exception where they said no, but they do have that option. If they say, no, I think this person should be the president instead, they can cast their ballot that way. So there are some options here. We'd hate to think that could happen, but it's apparently within the law if that were to happen.
Yeah, it is within the law, and it's within the realm of possibility, because unlike in Canada, where you have, you know, the kind of election commission that oversees how things are done with Elections Canada, elections in the United States are at the state level, and then they're broken down even further to going down to the county level. So there really is no federal oversight on how things happen. So if a state decides to make its legislature or tell its legislature to pick electors that are going to be friendly to the president and not follow along with that popular vote, it is something that is simply allowed via the Constitution. And it really does throw into question here, you know, when the president complains about a rigged election, do we end up in a situation where it is a rigged election because the president has used his power to pull the Republicans in line with him and take the kind of wide cast and wide speaking vote and language from Americans and put it behind one party? There are a lot of questions as to how this election is going to be carried out. But when you talk about, you know, him talking about, or in 2000, it was about ballots. It still is about ballots right now because the president is just hell-bent on making sure mail-in ballots that could favor Democrats are thrown out before they're counted.
And it goes without saying, of course, that the president himself votes by mail, but apparently that one should count, but the other one shouldn't. But that's, again, just part of the Trump hypocrisy, I guess, that we've come to see on a pretty regular basis these days. Another rather troubling scenario is that, as you say, he's had this fight with mail-in ballots. Meaning the Trump team, have lost a couple of state court battles over the last couple of weeks, Reggie, about whether or not those mail-in ballots should be allowed, and actually whether or not they can be counted after November the 3rd. And some judges have already ruled and said, yes, as long as they're postmarked by November the 3rd, they should be counted. I got a sense that he's going to challenge that as well. And he apparently, the Attorney General, is making noises now as if he could seize those ballots until there's an investigation, which means they wouldn't be counted. So it can get pretty ugly here in the next little while.
It can, especially considering one of the states that's allowing ballots to be cast after the election day is Pennsylvania, which is a state that is hotly contested right now and could become the Florida of 2020 in being that deciding factor with a statistically close race right now between the president and between Joe Biden. And, you know, ballots are already a problem in Pennsylvania because we have what's called a naked ballot, where if you're sending a ballot by mail, it has to go inside a specific envelope, which goes inside another envelope. And if it's not within one of them, it can be thrown out. So there's kind of a new get out the vote campaign to ensure that everybody is casting their ballot properly here. But it feeds into that kind of message, the baseless claims, really, that the president is saying that mail-in ballots are all fraud. And you said it earlier, Donald Trump does vote by mail. He says absentee ballots are okay. But in 10 states, or at least 9, including D.C., anybody can get a ballot. They're just sent out in the mail. And that's where the president sees problems here. Even though there is no problem, there is no widespread fraud, the president is just fearful of a loss. And he really is setting the stage here for what's going to likely end up becoming a contested election.
Yeah, of course, in that argument, he doesn't talk about the fact that there has to be validation of that ballot. You just can't fill it out and say, I'm voting for so-and-so and mail it back in. They're looking for social insurance numbers, validation of self and things like this, which is why, as I think you mentioned in one of your previous discussions with us, Reggie, mail-in balloting has been going on since the Civil War down in the States. And all of a sudden, this time around, he seems to think that that it's scandalous and it shouldn't be counted. So that debate will rage probably well past November the 3rd, I guess, depending on what's going to happen. A couple of other quick points I could ask you about. And I said we weren't specifically going to talk about COVID. Well, now we are, because of the vaccine debate that's going on down there. You've got Dr. Fauci and Dr. Redfield and others suggesting it's probably going to be springtime or early summer before there is a vaccine readily available for the public. The president, of course, is maintaining it's going to be done next month. And I know he butted heads yesterday with some members of the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, who said they will not release a drug until they're sure it's going to be effective and safe. In an amazing move, the president said, I will determine whether it's effective or safe, not you. So he's basically jumping over the FDA and said, I alone will make that determination. I don't know if he's got the authority to do that. He seems to think he has the authority to do everything. But that really muddies the water here.
Well, it does. And I mean, look, this is a president who for 4 years has said, you know, he knows elections better than anyone. He knows medicine better than anyone. He knows kind of everything and anything better than anyone else. And he put that on display last night. Look, the Food and Drug Administration has said that they are going to come out with stricter standards on a vaccine to ensure its efficacy and safety is going to be in the best interest of Americans. And the president is simply saying, look, this emergency authorization use that we're giving to the FDA to ensure that things go quicker, that he's simply going to try and override that to bring a vaccine up quicker solely so that he can have a gift on and by election day to say, look, I said that we were rounding the corner and here's that corner. It's now behind us and here's a vaccine for you. That's going to spark problems within the Republican Party, within America, because there already are a lessening number in the United States when it comes to people who say that they're going to get the first round of any kind of vaccine because they are fearful that it's being rushed through too quickly. The majority of Democrats say no. Even 30 or 40% of Republicans say that they're not going to get this kind of vaccine. But for the president to now kind of Bigfoot his own administration and the medical experts who are the ones trying to get this out there, it really is showing that there is a strain on what is happening between the White House, the medical association, and how that's leading to a kind of a broader confusion around the United States.
We've seen a bit of a change in attitude with some of those folks. I mean, Dr. Fauci has always been, I think, pretty steady in his assertions about what's going on with COVID and the vaccine. Dr. Redfield and Dr. Birx, two of the people that were on the task force that were there for those daily briefings in the early part up on the podium, have been accused of being a little wishy-washy on this, but both of them are starting to speak out against the administration right now. I don't know if that's a sense of frustration or they finally feel that, look, somebody's got to take a stand here.
Well, I think it could be a mix of both, and I think that there's just an understanding now that, you know, America crossed that 200,000 death threshold just a couple of days ago, and kind of key models that are used out of the University of Washington say that figure could be doubled in just 3 or 4 months, and I think the kind of the gravity of the situation is now weighing down the people who are ultimately responsible for the health and safety of Americans. And yesterday we found out that Dr. Birx is kind of on the verge of saying that she's had enough of dealing with what the politics inside the White House and the politics that are trying to lay the course for how this vaccine is going to come out. And she potentially could be moving towards the door without being forced and doing it on her own. There is kind of a crisis of conscience inside the medical community that's been associated with this coronavirus task force. And it is noticeable that when the president comes out to speak now, there is nobody from that task force who stands with him. We don't know if that's because of their own decision or because the White House is keeping them out, but that is leading to that growing confusion that we keep talking about in the country about what's happening with the virus.
That polarization in many people's minds is being caused, as some people are suggesting, by Dr. Scott Atlas, who was a recent addition to the task force, a Trump appointee, of course, who has some rather bizarre views about COVID and about vaccines.
Well, and this is also a person who has absolutely no background and history in infectious diseases. It's a neuroradiologist who has made questionable comments, but is, again, kind of a person who's in line with the president. And we've seen what happens. If you kind of disagree with the president publicly, it leads to a public removal from being able to kind of stand with the president and answer questions. If anyone saw that press conference yesterday with the president, he answered a couple of questions about COVID and then out of the middle of nowhere had to take a quote-unquote emergency phone call and left Scott Atlas there to answer the rest of these questions when he is a person who has had kind of no, you know, trip around the block for the last 4 or 5 months with the coronavirus task force. So this is just the president doing what he can to latch on to any kind of person who will be able to put his message out there, because we're 40 days out from an election and the president is suffering in the polls. So he's doing what he can to make sure that his message gets to his base, not the broader public.
Tumultuous times, and as, by the way, we haven't even got into this, but we're just a few days away from the first presidential debate, too, which is going to happen early next week. As always, Reggie, we look forward to reporting on Global National about this and really appreciate the time you spent with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Reggie Cicchini, of course, Global News down in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We've talked about the impact of COVID-19 on small businesses, and boy, the folks in London are certainly feeling it as well. I want to bring Andrew Graham into the conversation. Andrew, of course, is a reporter at 980 CFPL. Andrew, I read the piece that you posted yesterday about the meeting that a number of small business owners in the downtown core had. And according to your piece here, I guess the characterization is, I mean, they were all suffering, but they seemed to be doing a lot better through the summer until you got this latest news about the outbreak.
Yeah, and that's really what's driving the lack of consumer confidence, as they're referring to it. Again, you have these three outbreaks. Most of them are linked to, you know, activity downtown, and people are associating the two and saying, well, I don't want to go downtown. And even this past weekend, local health officials and the restaurants themselves noticed a huge drop in customers coming in, people just being afraid to go downtown because, you know, they don't want to get infected.
This is a pretty popular area. I mean, I've been down that area for many times. I mean, especially this time of year, in an ordinary day before COVID, of course, you know, with the university students back in town, it's a pretty busy area. A lot of the restaurants are doing great business. Why the reticence, though? I mean, as I say, they seem to be doing all right. I know there's been some new cases. Is there a concern that the spread is a lot greater than they thought?
I think there really is. And I think, again, when you have businesses being linked to these outbreaks or being named alongside, you know, news reports of these outbreaks, I think people just associate the two and then almost put a blanket vision over all the businesses downtown. And that's what these businesses are scared about. You know, they don't want to be lumped in all to the same category, because they say, you know, all of us, we're doing our part, and the overwhelming majority of businesses in London have not had any cases related to their staff, employees, or customers.
So with that in mind, a number of them got together, and we're talking about a wide variety here. We're talking about restaurants, I know specifically, but this covers the gamut. This is, you know, the opticians, a number of other businesses down there as well. Is the intent here just to get the word out? Are they looking for help from local councils? What's going on here?
It really is that. It's looking for consumer confidence, you know, and they're kind of harking back to the summer. As you mentioned, they were doing very well in the summer, and that was when London was seeing, you know, relatively low single-day case increases. So our case numbers weren't that high. And then obviously these past few weeks in London, we've seen, you know, people making huge lines at testing centers. We've seen people change their consumer behavior. And they're just saying, you know, local business is still there. We still need your support. I mean, if you're afraid to come downtown, at least order online. They're just looking for some support because, I mean, as they've been telling us, they've been struggling. I mean, it's that's nothing new to anyone here. Everyone knows the restaurant industry and just local business have been, you know, really suffering under the pandemic from an economic standpoint. So they really just want to let it hit home that, you know, they do need the help. They do need support and they don't want to be forgotten.
One of the more troubling stories, I guess, was from Dr. Pepe from Old North Optometry. And, of course, their backlog, because they had to shut down for a period of time. So, like a lot of other health-related industries, they're trying to catch up now and bring people back in. Hey, I know you missed your appointment, but... And she was saying that a lot of people are reticent to go downtown. I don't want the appointment just yet. Let's wait until this goes on. That's got to be awfully frustrating.
Exactly. And, you know, I was speaking to her, too, and she says, you know, we're following every single guideline and more. She'll even do extra stuff at her optometry to make sure everyone feels safe. But even then, people are, you know, they still have this fear associated with downtown. And, I mean, if you're a consumer and you don't want to get infected, I mean, obviously the advice is to stay home and whatnot. So it's hard to go around that. But at the same time, these businesses, they need the support, especially local businesses. You know, they really do rely on that local customer base.
I know you talked to a number of the folks that are involved in this and expressing concerns. Now, when they did start to reopen and the protocol was put in place by the provincial government about the sorts of things they had to do, and in some cases, of course, there were barriers that are put, plexiglass barriers, certainly masking, social distancing, things of this nature, but also sanitizing, you know, cleaning door handles and cleaning off tables after service, et cetera, like this. And I know a few of the businesses were saying it's really onerous. It's time-consuming, and it's awfully frustrating. I think they understand that it has to be done, but it's really put a lot of pressure on them as small business people.
Yeah, what I heard was that, you know, when you pay for the PPE, the plexiglass barriers, things like that, you know, the government grants are helping with that. But what's not taken into account is all the labor costs of enforcing those guidelines. That includes having extra staff on hand just to monitor that everyone has their masks on, having extra staff put in extra hours doing these tasks that don't really contribute to the business in general. For example, if you're a restaurant and you have an employee who's spending 20 minutes just, you know, wiping down door handles, that's not something you'd usually account for in a business. So it's just this extra added labor cost that's really taking up not just their money, but also their time from their employees.
Well, I've seen that in grocery stores. You know, there's usually one person right at the front door as you walk into the grocery store to make sure that you're sanitized and maybe, you know, wipe down a cart for you. And maybe they can afford that. But in a small business where you might only have six or seven employees, it's got to be very difficult to dedicate one employee to do cleaning all the time as opposed to some of the other work that they should be doing.
Exactly. And especially with these restaurants. I mean, the restaurant industry, that's a tough industry. And one person I spoke to, he just opened up a restaurant in Northeast London on March 8th. About a week later, he was forced to shut down and then was forced to do takeout only. And to do takeout only for a new restaurant, that's a very scary avenue to take. So again, you know, these are people who are already in a tough industry, already dealing with all the challenges that come with that industry, and now they have a pandemic on top of it. And from what they tell me, you know, the source of their frustration really comes from having none of this in their control. I mean, they can't control if an outbreak's going to happen. They can't control if, you know, 30 plus Western students are going to get COVID-19. So, I mean, they're really just dealing with things day by day, and they have no real way to plan ahead, because if you do plan ahead, you're not really going to get there because things change. We see this pandemic, you know, everything's flexible. You need to adapt. So it's a very tough situation.
Are they concerned about the future? And I'm talking about the short future here, first of all, because we have seen, not just in London, but right across the province, the number of cases have increased significantly to the point where the premier said, look, we may have to start looking at restrictions again, which has got to be the worst possible thing these businesses want to hear right now.
It definitely is, and it definitely is a big fear. You know, if these businesses were forced to shut down again, I really don't think many could take it. And we've seen research that says the same. You know, we've already seen a number, a really big number of businesses across Ontario and across Canada being forced to close because of the pandemic. But at the end of the day, I do think there is optimism. You know, they do have a belief in the local community coming out to show that support. And they've said they've been really helped by loyal customers who've really been helping keep them afloat. So I think there is optimism, there is hope, but obviously that's all mixed in with a lot of fear of just not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, or even a month after.
Yeah, I know, and the comments we heard, even from federal and provincial members right now, it's not encouraging. I know the last thing the premier wants to do is to start shutting businesses down again, but if the numbers go up, and apparently they went up again today, over yesterday, which is rather troubling for us, it only exacerbates, I guess, the problem that these businesses are feeling. I mean, you know, yesterday you had this great story that you filed, and maybe people are going to hear that and say, hey, okay, maybe we'll give it a shot. And then you hear the number of cases go up again. Well, maybe not. It's kind of like one step forward and two steps back for a lot of these businesses.
It really is, and I think the best way to track this, at least in London, is just, you know, check out how things look downtown over the weekend. I mean, that really has been the best indicator for how business is doing right now. Last week, health officials were noting that on Friday, Saturday, usually very busy days for downtown, during the nighttime, you know, there was almost no one there. It's almost a ghost town. So clearly people are reacting to these outbreaks. So if we see that again this week, the week after, then that's definitely tough. But I mean, over the summer, you know, London was very, very popular downtown, very busy downtown. And we had people going out to restaurants very busy. So I do think London can get back to that situation so long as the local case counts remain relatively low. But we'll have to just wait and see.
It's got to be exceptionally frustrating for especially the restaurant and bar owners in a situation like this, Andrew, because, I mean, even the last 10 days or so, the weather has been unusually warm and nice. It's great patio weather. If folks would just come downtown and partake in that sort of thing. They've got to be looking at this as a lost opportunity. Boy, we really could have made up some ground this week.
Especially with, you know, just winter around the corner, because a lot of these businesses are going to lose their outdoor seating. So, as you mentioned, they really do want to take advantage of this warm weather while it's still here. The business owners I was talking to, they said that, you know, right now most of their extra money is being put into all these winter supplies they normally wouldn't need to carry. That includes, you know, patio heaters, outdoor fans, things along those lines to, you know, provide a comfortable experience in the winter. But I mean, even doing that's kind of a hard task. You don't know what winter's going to bring, especially in Canada. So.
Especially in London, southwestern Ontario. Come on, I love it down there. But, you know, when my brother was going to university there, he said, yeah, spring fell on a Tuesday this year. But because, you know, you're right in the snow belt there. It's what happens. But I'm hoping the weather holds out, and I'm hoping that people get the message here and start going into some of these local businesses, which they probably used to frequent on a regular basis anyway. And there's a little paranoia, and I guess it's understandable with a lot of people to say, well, look, it's, you know, the second wave. Should I really expose myself? But the element to this, of course, is we do have a game plan. And I'm sure that, I know that's one of the things, according to the piece that you filed yesterday, Andrew, is that they're reminding them, look, if you wear masks and if you're sanitizing and doing the social distancing thing, you're mitigating the impact of this. You know, it's not as if you're setting yourself into a hornet's nest. It can work that way as long as everybody's playing by the rules.
Exactly. And that really is the main messaging they want to, you know, give to Londoners, that it's still safe to come downtown. It's still safe to visit these businesses. You know, I mean, again, all these businesses, the ones I spoke to at least, none of them have had a single case related to COVID-19. And that's the case for most businesses in London, too. So they again, just don't want to be painted under this same blanket, don't want to be painted in the same photo, in the same picture here, because, as I mentioned, you know, these businesses are doing everything they can, and sometimes even more, to protect their customers.
Great reporting on this, and here's hoping the message gets out and people start looking at it as an opportunity while they still can, and let's try to keep these businesses going and hopefully flourishing at some point in the future, too. Andrew, as always, thanks so much for the time. Great talking with you again today.
Thank you, Bill.
Take care. Andrew Graham, of course, from 980 CFPL News. Good piece online, by the way. You should check out and get some of the reaction from some of those local restaurateurs and other businesses in the downtown area that are looking for us to get back in there. And I get it. I understand some of the frustration, some of the concern, and some of the hesitation. But by the same token, as I say, they've had no cases. They are doing everything they're supposed to do. They put all the equipment in that they're supposed to do. And if you do what you're supposed to do, i.e. face masking, et cetera, and sanitization, go and have a nice time. Have a drink on the patio. Grab a burger, whatever it might be. Even a veggie burger, whatever you want to do. Anyway, listen, I also got to talk about something else because Hamilton City Council met yesterday. We had talked with a number of councillors and with Mayor Eisenberger over the last little while about the impact that the virus was having on municipal budgets, and it has been devastating. However, the federal and provincial governments did come to the rescue to a certain extent. Yet, when they were going to get an update on this yesterday, I know a lot of councillors I talked to were rather apprehensive, figuring, okay, here comes more bad news. But it looks like the deficit they were expecting may not be a deficit after all. Chad Collins, the councillor for Ward 5 in the east end of the city, joins us to talk about this. Chad, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime you get financial updates like this, Chad, I know you're kind of hoping for the best but expecting the worst oftentimes. Yesterday was a good news story, and you haven't had very many of those lately.
No, you're right. And, you know, it's been a very challenging year for everyone, not just here in Hamilton, but all around the world. And so we started with very bleak financial picture in the spring. We had a over $61 million forecast deficit for the year, which would have been a record for us, and it's not unique to Hamilton. All municipalities across the country are facing huge financial losses as it relates to declining revenues and increased expenditures. So the original report was over $61 million, and just in the last couple of weeks, we've received tremendous news as it relates to the assistance that we've received from both the province and the federal government. We can be their biggest critics because we're always fighting for our local residents and, you know, looking for increased support from the province and the federal government for all issues where where the responsibility falls upon all three levels of government to provide a service. And so we have criticized them in the past, and I think in this instance we need to commend them for stepping up to the plate and delivering on their promises. They said they...
We lost Chad? I think we might have a bad connection here. We'll try to get Councillor Collins back on in just a couple of seconds, see if we can reestablish contact. The budget $62 million pandemic deficit that was forecast, and Councillor Collins is absolutely right. The federal and provincial assistance programs that were in place for a number of different communities certainly have been effective on this, but it wasn't going to cover everything. I mean, they knew that coming up front. I think we've got Councillor Collins back. You with us, Chad?
Yep. Sorry, Bill. Looks like I cut out there on my cell phone.
Oh, it happens. Everybody's working remotely these days. It's going to happen. And then I know you were just lauding the city staff, for doing the had to be done. But to your credit, council had to make some tough decisions here too, about closing some facilities, some temporary layoffs, and not doing any new hires. I mean, you've really got to go through every line in the budget when you're looking for those sorts of efficiencies in a drastic time like this.
Yeah, and I think in addition to thanking the Prime Minister and the Premier, our senior leadership team has done some tremendous work in terms of looking for ways and means in which to limit the damage to the city's budget. And they've essentially done that over the last several months. It's been a very challenging year. It meant, as you just mentioned, not hiring and filling new positions. We're living this year with far less students than we've ever operated with before, and that means some of the services that we provide on the street have either been delayed or we're not addressing them. And, you know, whether it's less landscaping and less flowers in the boulevards and things like that, we've had to make some sacrifices in terms of ensuring that the deficit is tackled. And so it's been a joint effort between the provincial and federal governments who've done tremendous work in terms of being there for us and our senior leadership team with obviously council's support.
And when you do close facilities, we've talked about this with a number of mayors in the area over the last little while, of course you're losing revenue because, you know, they're not using the facilities, they're not using user fees, and that's money that you were expecting to get that you didn't, and that's problematic. There's also the concern about property taxes, and part of the update, as I see it yesterday, that you got from Mr. Zagaric is that I guess most people were paying their property taxes. I know there are some people that have been delinquent on rents and other things like this, but it's not as if you're rife with money right now, but that was a major concern that a lot of people may not be able to do that. But it looks like things are going to be relatively okay.
In that regard, at least for now, knock on wood, we did waive the fees, penalties, and interest for a period of time during the year. And we noted that there was, I think, 20% for the tax payment that was due during the summer months. 20% of Hamiltonians, whether they be businesses or residents, did not make a tax payment. It was a deferral, essentially. But it looks like those numbers are climbing back to where they should be. And so I think there's just some big question marks, Bill, in terms of what 2021 holds in store for us. We still see HSR ridership and revenues are down. We're at the 60% level of where they'd normally be. You know that during an economic downturn, even for, those that wouldn't even be considered a recession, we see massive increases on the social housing wait list. And so we know that there are some pressures coming with social services. And then, of course, what happens with recreation? A lot of our facilities are still closed. We don't see organized sports coming back anytime soon. So there's a lot of questions in terms of what happens there. And so from transit to recreation, to a number of other areas within the organization, there's just some big question marks in terms of what 2021 holds in store for us. And it'll be a big challenge for, I think, our staff and council to determine what the 2021 budget should look like in that regard.
Well, exactly. And maybe the biggest nut that you need to crack here is, will there be any federal and provincial assistance this time around? Because when they gave you those checks last time, and it didn't cover everything. I mean, you guys still had an awful lot of work to do, and you apparently have done that. But there was no guarantee, and they told you that up front, that, look, this is 2020. We don't know what's going to happen. And now that we're seeing what looks like it's a second wave right now, I can understand that that everybody on council is pretty nervous right now.
Yeah, I think we're very fortunate to get the resources we have this year from the province and the feds. And I think through yesterday's report and the presentation, it was deemed historic. And it really is in terms of the amount of resources that we receive for those. Next year is a different story. I mean, the question is, how long can the province and the federal government help everyone? I mean, they've been there for people who've been laid off. They've been there for people who can't find employment. They've been there for businesses. They've been there for municipalities. And I just don't know how long their budgets can sustain the social safety net, financial social safety net that they provided, as well as the supports for businesses as well. So that's a big question. And of course, again, the city will have its own issues to deal with as more people are working from home. We see empty city parking lots and the revenues attached to those. Obviously, transit revenues are down in a record way. So our organization's been hit. And of course, there's all the new public health, requirements that we're required to provide for not just our employees, but for the public who are using our facilities in terms of the protective equipment and social distancing requirements and those types of things. So lots of questions for 2021. I think as you started the this piece here today, Bill, you emphasized that at least for 2020, we're pretty much out of the woods on that one, and it looks good going into 2021 as it relates to a year-end variance that is almost break-even, but 2021 is certainly a different question.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, you guys had about 5 minutes to enjoy the good news yesterday, and then now you're right back into it. Good luck with it, Chad. We'll stay in touch. Thanks for the time today.
Thanks, Bill.
Take care. Ward 5 Councillor Chad Collins from Hamilton City Council.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.